Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week in Utah, a 25-year-old defendant was sent to prison for 55 years. His crime, selling 8 ounces of marijuana to a police informant on 3 occasions, in possession of a handgun during 2 of the transactions. The judge said he had no choice but to impose the sentence under federal law. He did so, he said, reluctantly, and from the bench called the sentence unjust, cruel, and even irrational. But he also said he had no option because a federal mandatory minimum law required what may well, in effect, be a life sentence. Meanwhile, the U.S. Supreme Court is about to take up the whole issue of federal sentencing guidelines. Nearly 20 years after Washington got tough with sentencing standards, the whole system is under unprecedented critical scrutiny. Tonight on Point, we're looking at American crime and punishment and the country's inflexible sentencing guidelines themselves on trial. We begin tonight with Steve Henderson. He's U.S. Supreme Court correspondent for the Knight Ridder newspaper group. He joins us from Baltimore. Steve, thanks for being with us tonight.
No problem.
When we hear the cases, this can be very dramatic stuff. It can also be a little bit confusing. There's a couple of angles under criticism here. One, mandatory minimum sentences, but then this much larger issue of sentencing guidelines that the Supreme Court is taking up. Describe the ferment that's going on around sentencing policy in the United States, if you can, for us, Steve.
Sure. For about 20 years in this country, we've had, at least at the federal level, and many states have followed suit, what we call sentencing guidelines, which grew out of the crime reform movement of the mid-1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And what these guidelines do is, or what they were intended to do really, was to remove a lot of judicial discretion from the process. Prior to the guidelines, you know, two people who committed the same crime wouldn't have no expectation of receiving the same sentence.
They had no idea what it would be. And when this was done, there was bipartisan support. Ted Kennedy and
Absolutely.
Strom Thurmond on the same team. Senator Edward Kennedy's described past sentencing as like roulette.
Yes, that's right. I've seen a quote somewhere that, you know, you had no idea, you know, if the judge had had a bad breakfast that morning, you know, if he'd take it out on you in court and sentence you to a longer jail term. I mean, there really was not much rhyme or reason at all.
So this was supposed to be a major step toward fairer, more effective criminal justice. How has it evolved? How's it perceived?
It's sort of evolved that way in general, there aren't the wide discrepancies in total that you used to see. The problem is that because there are certain things that require mandatory sentences, there are oddball cases and anomalous cases where, you know, somebody who seems to be a small-time criminal or have committed a petty crime ends up in jail for 55 years. And so those are the things that give momentum to those who would criticize the guidelines and say that they remove too much discretion from the hands of judges.
Now, let's look at two cases here quickly, if we could. First, the one in Utah this week. The judge there saying, this is irrational, this is cruel, this is not justice. But he had to do it, even though under Utah state law it might have just been a half dozen years in prison for Mr. Angelos. Instead, it's 55 years. He's 25 now. There's no parole, I guess, under federal guidelines, so it could easily be a life sentence.
Yeah.
But the judge had to do it. Why?
The judge had to do it because he committed a few of the crimes with a handgun. And one of the things that the federal guidelines allows for is and calls for is enhanced sentencing for people for aggravating circumstances. So,
but it's not even that he was waving that handgun. He had a Glock on his ankle in one of these transactions, and somewhere in the house during another.
Right. Yeah. well, it's possession is the trigger there, and as an aggravator, that can increase your sentence substantially in the federal system. And you know, is it fair? I think that's what, you know, certainly Judge Cassell is saying it wasn't fair in this case.
Judge Cassell and 29 other former judges and prosecutors saying this is cruel and unusual punishment. This should be prohibited by under the Eighth Amendment.
Yeah. I think there's a lot. There are a lot of people who are coming very, very rapidly to that point of view that the guidelines don't make sense across the board. And like I said, in general, what we're seeing is much more uniformity in sentences these days than we used to. But again, you know, because the guidelines, are imperfect, and because they deal with certain kinds of things more harshly than others, I mean, gun carrying being one of them, you do end up with cases in which, people who shouldn't really be the target of, you know, very tough sentencing end up in jail for a long time.
Now, on a broader scale, those 1980s reforms had not only to do with this kind of drug sentencing, but with much broader federal crimes. They set up a whole matrix of sentencing guidelines.
Yes.
And over the summer, the Supreme Court issued a ruling which many have seen as shaking that whole structure of guidelines in the case of Blakely versus Washington. Why is that shaking now, Steve?
Well, that's actually that's sort of an aside issue, really, but it's become the primary issue because of what the court did. The Supreme Court in that case said that the part of Washington State's guidelines that permitted the judges to find aggravating facts at sentencing that would add to your sentence. So, for example, in this case, the guy had kidnapped his ex-wife. The judge found that he had acted in an excessively cruel manner and was not showing remorse for having committed the crime.
So in this case, it wasn't a mandatory minimum we're talking about. The judge wanted to exceed the maximum under the guidelines.
Well, he didn't. He couldn't exceed the maximum. But what he could do was, you know, the guidelines give you a range, right? They give you a minimum below which you're not supposed to go, and a maximum above which we're not supposed to go.
Right, and what to consider in between.
And what to consider in between, that's right. And what the court is saying is that in-between area cannot be defined by judges alone, that if you want to say somebody's been excessively cruel or is not showing remorse or, you know, had, you know, six bags of heroin instead of three, those are facts that should be submitted to a jury, and that the Sixth Amendment, which guarantees our right to trial by jury, requires that it prevents judges from doing that. Now, when they said that about Washington State scheme, that raised questions about the federal sentencing scheme, because one of the things that the federal sentencing guidelines allows for is enhanced sentencing based on aggravating factors by a judge.
Without the jury's input. And so in that ruling, the whole schema of sentencing guidelines was suddenly kind of up in the air.
Yeah, I mean, it really set off a firestorm in lower courts this summer. I mean, there were judges across the country who had defendants in front of them and all of a sudden no idea as to how to sentence them. They were afraid that if they used the guidelines, the sentence could be challenged and overturned. If they didn't use the guidelines, in some cases, you'd have defendants who were guilty of pretty serious crimes getting, you know, a few months in jail instead of many, many years.
Steve, we're going to hear in just a moment from a judge who's been in the thick of this and sharing his thoughts. But finally, the Supreme Court is now looking at two cases. We'll look at them soon, one from Wisconsin, one from Maine, that many are hoping will clarify this picture. How's that likely to unfold? What are those cases going to contribute to this discussion?
You know, what we hope to get from those cases is a clearer picture of what effect this really has. And really the question is, did they really mean it when they said you couldn't do this? And does that mean you absolutely can't do it? I mean, the level of confusion among federal judges right now, I think, can't be underestimated. It's really intense, and I think what people are hoping is that the justices will come back and say, okay, here's the effect that this ought to have on the federal sentence guidelines, and here's what you ought maybe, you know, they don't often do this, but here's what you're going to have to do to fix them.
And in the meantime, nobody knows, and Weldon Angelos is headed off, failing an appeal, to 55 years in prison. Quite a case. Steve Henderson, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
No problem.
Steve Henderson is U.S. Supreme Court correspondent for the Knight Ridder Newspaper Group, and he spoke with us from Baltimore. You can join our conversation tonight. We're talking about sentencing minimums and maximums and the latitude judges should have in sentencing. What do you think? Are mandatory sentences working as deterrents, as genuine justice? And should judges have more discretion, more say, or should the law be unbending? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is the senior judge for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, Donald P. Lay. Judge Lay hears the Eighth Circuit cases in St. Paul, Minnesota, and joins us tonight from Deerwood, Minnesota. Judge Lay, thanks very much for being with us.
I'm very pleased to be with you.
You've been writing just this week. We read your op-ed piece in the New York Times and saying people are up in arms and have reason to be. What has judges so upset about sentencing guidelines these days, Judge Lay?
Well, my interest in peace at this point was not on the mandatory or minimum limits of sentencing in the criminal cases. Actually, I don't think it's the sentencing guidelines that require the mandatory or minimum figures. It's actually the congressional edicts that have come down interpreting the guidelines.
Right. We've got two different bodies of law or guidelines at work here, granted, but you're saying still this issue of latitude and sentencing needs attention.
Well, there is no question. And my article in the New York Times was focusing upon the drug crimes. We have about 47% of our total prison population in the federal courts that are there under drug convictions. And it seems to me what we all should be interested in is, number one, the deterrent and prevention of crime in this country, and number two, how we can turn people around and make them into using their lives for useful purposes.
And you're saying that about 13% of those convicted of drug charges who go to special counseling are rearrested, compared with 47% of the type who go to, for prison time. And as a judge, you don't have discretion once the federal laws get involved.
Well, I don't know. I think you're misunderstanding the figures of the percentage. What I've pointed out is that through the use of state drug courts,
yes,
where they are taking prisoners or people that are to be tried or that have already been convicted, and they are facing these mandatory and minimum accounts for drug convictions, that through the use of the state drug courts, we're finding 13% of those that go through the state drug courts and use state drug treatments outside of prison, that these people are only 13% are rearrested.
Right.
Those that do not participate in the state drug courts, their statistics, and these statistics come from New York, which is, I think, a good testing ground. About 47% of the people that haven't gone through the drug treatment programs are rearrested as soon as they, or not as soon as, but shortly after they have been convicted.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think that's statistical evidence that the state drug courts are being successful, and that we're deterring crime, and we're turning people about without having to spend, around in their lives, so they don't have to spend this time in incarceration.
And that is when you've got the option. Judge Lay, please stand by. We're talking tonight about crime and punishment and America's sentencing guidelines. Right now, on trial, you can join the conversation when a 25-year-old in Salt Lake City is sent away for 55 years for selling 24 ounces of pot. Is something out of whack or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking about crime and punishment tonight and America's inflexible sentencing guidelines. Right now, it would seem, on trial. You can join the conversation tonight. When a judge is forced to deliver a mandatory sentence and complains that it's way too much, in the words of the judge we heard last week, Judge Castle, that it's unjust, cruel, and even irrational, is it time for reform? Do you remember why minimum sentencing guidelines were imposed in the first place? Have they served their purpose? Have they instilled a useful fear of tough justice or something else? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been joined tonight from Minnesota by Judge Donald P. Lay. He's senior judge for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, author of a New York Times op-ed piece this week entitled Rehab Justice. We're joined right now from Columbus, Ohio, by Douglas Berman. He's professor of law at the Merritt School of Law at Ohio State University, co-author of a new casebook entitled Sentencing Law and Policy, editor for the last 10 years of the Federal Sentencing Reporter. Douglas Berman, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
We're trying to get our heads around this big kind of gangly issue of sentencing guidelines, mandatory minimums, and all the rest. Douglas Berman, why is there so much ferment right now about this? Paint the picture for us. What is in play here and what's at stake?
Sure. I can paint it sort of in two terms, and I'll sound a little lawyerly here for a second, but
okay.
Hopefully I can make it clear.
We'll try and stay with you.
There are challenges to the substance of the sentencing laws, and so I think the decision out of Utah involving the 55-year sentence for this small-time drug dealer, that creates concern because 55 years just seems unnecessarily long. And so the decision about how long he has to go to prison and the fact that the judge in this case has no authority to make a different judgment based on the complete picture of the case. The point is that these congressionally enacted mandatory sentences pick out one feature of a case,
right,
and then mandate particularly harsh punishment for it. And so in the case of Weldon Angelos, it was the fact that he had this gun, and that mandated tying the judge's hands to the idea that this very long sentence had to be imposed. And I know that the federal judges for quite some time have been concerned with the length of sentences and the lack of discretion they have to adjust sentences based on all the features in the case. And so that's something that's sort of been gurgling in a variety of settings for quite some time.
Judge Cassell saying if you hijacked an airplane, it would only be 25 years. Terrorist bombing intending to kill, 20 years. Second-degree murder, 14 years. Kidnapping, 13. Rape, 11. And here it's selling drugs, and there was a gun, but 55 years.
Absolutely, and that's a highlighting the fact that Congress is particularly focused on drug crimes and weapons and has ratcheted up the sentences in ways that particular fact, and in the Angelos case particularly, the fact that the prosecutors charged him with a series of crimes that all were consolidated at one sentencing,
right,
was part of what drove the sentence to be so high. And so that's sort of the story about the substance of sentencing that really has been a concern for many federal judges for quite some time. I think Judge Lay, who was speaking to you before, was reflecting some of those concerns that in drug cases across the board, sentencing to imprisonment rather than looking for other alternatives has been a concern of judges in the federal system and to some extent in state systems as well.
So there's one side of the ledger. Judge Lay, I hear you there.
Yeah, I just say my concern was that we have over 1,500 state drug courts in this country, but we don't have any such system in the federal courts.
Mm-hmm.
And now just last month I heard a case where a 19-year-old girl let her boyfriend use her apartment to sell some methamphetamine.
Mm-hmm.
And she was held as an aider and abettor, and she received a 20-year sentence. And I'm like Judge Cassell. I just think this is just so sad. And even the U.S. Attorney's Office said that that young lady deserved clemency. But under the guidelines, that's what they get.
Judge Lee, let me ask you, just on that front, can you see, you know, some people argue that this at a higher level ends up being a deterrent. Here's a spokesman for the Justice Department. This is Monica Goodling saying, tough but fair mandatory minimum sentences take habitual lawbreakers off the street, lock up the most dangerous criminals, help ensure the safety of law-abiding Americans. She says the public, the Congress, and presidents of both parties have supported mandatory minimums for a simple reason. They work. What do you say to that, Judge Lay?
Well, I know that's the mindset of many that feel that longer sentences keep people off the streets, but in the 40 years that I've been on the court, and 20 of those have been while they've had the guidelines mm-hmm. and these mandatory sentences, crime has not gone down, and the drug crimes particularly have not gone down. And we need a way to deter these drug crimes. And I think the statistics that I've given to you before mm-hmm. about out of New York are proof that they will go down if these people are given or the opportunity for treatment rather than incarceration.
Mm. So there's the mandatory side, that what you call, Douglas Berman, the substantive side. And then there's another big half, at least, of this issue right now around the sentencing guidelines on a larger scale. Help us understand that.
Sure, and I would call these issues procedural because
okay.
what the Supreme Court addressed in the Blakely case that I know was discussed a little bit earlier mm-hmm. was not the substance. They're not focused on what the final sentence is directly,
right.
but rather what procedure is used
to get to
determine the facts that lead up to those sentences.
Mm-hmm.
And historically, it's always been thought that judges could make that kind of fact-finding. And these guideline systems that we've been talking about have all been constructed around the assumption that judges could be the essential fact-finder for doing these judgments at sentencing. And the Supreme Court's Blakely decision created such an earthquake because it seemed to hold that juries had to be the finders of these facts.
And that is, the judge was counted on to perceive the context around the details of the crime and to relate the sentence to that bigger context or fact-finding, as you describe it.
And these guideline systems, in fact, have very specified rules, particularly in the federal system. If there's a certain amount of drugs involved, the judge should move the sentencing range up a certain amount.
Right.
If there's a gun involved, if there's a certain kind of victim, certain kind of harm to the victim, all of those, these guideline rules specify how the judge is to respond to those facts. And it's always been thought that the judges could make those factual determinations after the defendant pled guilty or after there was a jury trial on the main offense. And what this Blakely decision seems to suggest is all of those, you might call smaller factual judgments, also have to be made by a jury or admitted by the defendant
before
the sentencing can go forward.
So when you watch the Supreme Court as it takes up this Wisconsin case and the main case, Booker, Fanfan, what are you going to be watching for? What's at stake as they decide these cases around procedure and sentencing guidelines?
Fundamentally, it's whether the procedures that have been utilized in the federal courts for the last 15 years can continue the way they've been going, because it has been sort of central and essential and sort of built into the very fabric of federal sentencing that judges would make all of these factual determinations. And that's exactly what the federal guideline rules mandated. And the Blakely decision said, judges, you can't do that in this Washington state system.
Right.
And the reason it created such an earthquake in the federal system is everybody looked around and said, well, gosh, they do it even more in the federal system.
That's essentially what we're doing all over the place.
Yes, absolutely. And so that's why the judges were particularly at sea in the federal system to understand, well, can we continue doing business as usual? Do we need to completely change our rules so that juries are more centrally involved in making all of these sentencing determinations? And that's what the Supreme Court's going to speak directly to for the federal system in these cases out of Wisconsin and Maine.
And the potential consequences of their ruling there, will there be fresh appeals about old cases that will come back? How's it likely to ripple through the system?
Oh, there are going to be appeals at every level. There's going to be appeals of the folks who are currently in the pipeline. Those are the cases that are sort of most tangible, the cases that were sort of gearing up for sentencing right around the time of the Supreme Court decision. Those are all in the middle of sort of the courts right now. But there are also past cases, folks who have been in jail for very long periods of time, where their sentence was calculated by the judge finding all these facts. And they're starting to come to court and say, hey, if that was the wrong way to do things, right, I want a lower sentence.
And it's so wrong for me, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the kind of chaos picture that people are afraid of emerging here. Judge Lay, Douglas Berman, please stand by. A lot of callers want to join us, and I want to begin to turn to them. Tanya's calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, Tanya. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great, thanks. How are you?
Doing well. In comment to your statement about are the laws too strict or too high, the bottom line is the person broke the law. When a person is carrying a gun, they're carrying a gun for a reason. They don't intend for themselves to get hurt, but they certainly intend to hurt someone else. And the drugs themselves, out here in the street, there's a lot of children that are affected by it.
Right.
We have dropouts in school as a result of kids getting on drugs early, and these drug dealers out here, they don't care how young, they pick them to do their dirty deeds.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I don't think, when you really stop and back up, if one of these people that are talking about the law is too strict or that this person shouldn't spend 55 years of their life, but if this person was to go out there and shoot somebody's mother, brother, sister, and it happens every day, or get their child on drugs, I don't think they'd hesitate to take the law into their own hands. And then we have a balloon effect of who's right and who's wrong.
But Tanya, let me ask you, does it take 55 years to create a sufficient deterrent? Is there any length of sentence at which you begin to ask yourself, is that out of balance, out of whack?
It's hard to say what's out of balance and out of whack. If we look at other countries and what they do as far as justice in their country, if you steal food in some countries, you get your hand chopped off.
Would you like to see that in the USA?
No, but I would like to see a balance, yes. But where does the line draw to who's going to go to court, go to jail? And our judicial system already has a loophole available to most criminals. The laws are not created for the innocent people because the innocent people try to abide by them.
Well, but they sure did get a lot tougher in the 80s, and that's still being dealt with now. Tanya, thank you for that call. And Judge Lay, let me turn to you on that. You hear there the citizen response here, I'm worried about drugs. I'm worried about my children, about safety in the streets. This guy in Utah had not only drugs but a gun, so send him away. Good.
Well, I was with Tanya until she got to the word but. And I thought your questions to her as to whether they wanted their hands or legs or something chopped off were very relevant. I think we've got to find a way to deter crime. We're not doing it by sending people to prison for a longer period of time. We've got to send people to through drug treatments, and we must try to do this with a sane approach to what laws are present available. Let me say, when I first came on the court for about 20 years, we had what was called the indeterminate sentence rule. And what happened was that Congress just found that these laws created too much disparity, and that different people that committed the same crime would get different types of sentences. But we have more disparity today than we've ever had before. But at least at the time when the judges could do the indeterminate sentencing, that is, like a sentence would be 1 to 20.
Right.
And they would, the judge would get the, have the study of the probation department who would study the lifestyle and the involvement of the particular defendant and who they were surrounded with and so forth. And the judge had all of this information, and it was done on an individualized basis. And there's a particular portion in the sentencing guidelines itself that says that everything should be done on an individualized basis, and yet it is not. And it's just done by rote. And so what I think that and the federal judges are looking for is something that will at least bring a little sanity to this whole issue and try to set up something that will deter crime. You leave somebody in prison for 10 years, and they're going to come out and they're going to commit further crime. They're hardened criminals. If you let people stay in there, their lives are ruined. And I agree, selling drugs to children are going to create terrible problems for people. But I think we have a better approach to handling that problem by turning the sentencing back to judge.
Giving some discretion right there. Judge Lay, Douglas Berman, if you would stand by just for a moment. I have standing by, I want to welcome into the conversation from Ephrata, Washington, John Nodell. He is prosecuting attorney at Grant County Court in Ephrata, Washington. He was the prosecutor in the Blakely versus Washington case, which went to the Supreme Court this summer. The court, of course, rejected Washington State's sentencing guidelines, creating the earthquake that Douglas Berman was describing. John Nodell, thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, thanks for having me, Tom.
So here we are. There's a lot of ways of coming at this issue of sentencing and guidelines and mandatory minimums. You were right in the thick of it on the procedural guidelines part. As your case, Blakely versus Washington, was decided, could you feel that earthquake impending that Douglas Berman describes?
Well, we knew there was a lot at stake. Of course, Tom, the problem is when Blakely came down, it's very difficult to know exactly what it means and what implications it's going to have. And I think that's the earthquake we're feeling as the federal and state courts are trying to sort out the implications of the decision.
And what do you expect from these further cases that the Supreme Court's taken up from Wisconsin, from Maine? Are we going to see a wholesale reconsideration of sentencing procedures and guidelines in this country, or do you think they'll be more conservative?
You know, Tom, I have no idea. I did not expect to lose the case, so I guess I'm not a very good predictor about what the courts are going to do. But I think the Supreme Court did not invalidate our guidelines. Here in Washington, we're struggling to see if we can fix them in a manner that's consistent with what the Supreme Court says is required. And right now, we just have a lot of different proposals, and we don't know what's going to emerge and what the courts are going to do with what we come up with.
So you'll be watching very closely there, and of course, Douglas Berman, everybody else across the country as well. I think it's hard sometimes for lay people to keep track of this line between the procedural and the substantive, but you can't help listen to Tanya, the caller on the one hand, who says, look, we want a line drawn here, and then Judge Lay is saying, but you've got to have real justice.
That's right. And I think that's what's sort of being lost. I mean, we can talk about anomalous cases on both ends, but for every minor drug dealer who does 10, 15, 20 years, I think, you could find any prosecutor could point to a case where you've had a guy who's committed three or four serious violent offenses under indeterminate sentencing. I mean, we just have not done a very good job, in my opinion, under indeterminate sentencing when judges had unfettered discretion to deal with violent crime.
In the 1 to 20 kind of situation that Judge Lay describes there.
Right, right.
That's a big span. We've got a lot more to get into here and a lot of callers waiting to join us. John Nodell in Washington, Douglas Berman in Columbus, Ohio, Judge Lay in Minnesota. We're so glad you're all here. Please stick with us. We're talking tonight about crime and punishment and America's inflexible sentencing guidelines right now themselves on trial. You can join this conversation. What do you think? Have sentencing guidelines filled U.S. prisons with too many people for too long for the wrong crimes or not? And can judges be trusted to be wise and tough in the absence of strict guidelines? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking tonight about crime and punishment, about America's sentencing guidelines themselves right now on trial at a number of levels. You can join our conversation tonight. What do you think? Have sentencing guidelines warped American justice into something else? Is it time to put power and discretion back in the hands of American judges or not? Do you like it just the way it is? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by a terrific lineup, Donald P. Lay, judge, senior judge for the U.S. Court of Appeals, 8th Circuit in St. Paul, is with us tonight. From Ephrata, Washington, John Nodell. He's prosecuting attorney in Grant County Court there. He was the prosecutor in the Blakely versus Washington case that rocked the world of sentencing last summer before the Supreme Court. and Douglas Berman, professor of law at the Moritz School of Law at Ohio State University, editor for the last decade of the Federal Sentencing Reporter, very influential. Lots of callers want to join us right now. Mary is calling from Escanaba, Michigan. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Mary.
I would just like to let everybody know that I think it's very unfair, the whole, whether it's state or federal level. And both my husband and I have worked in the prison system. I was a nurse, and my husband was a correction officer.
Okay.
And we raised our son as a Christian, and we raised all of our children as Christians. And he happened to not want to attend bars to find a mate later on in life. So he did the internet thing while he was in the military. And now, because he was on a military reservation, met a girl online who said she was 18, basically he is being charged with rape because the girl ended up being 14 while he was 19, and he was there. And now he, because they threw it into the federal court system, they said that his minimum sentence will be 40 years to life. Now, that is very hard for a parent that worked in the system, and I'm like, what an unjust system. And I get very emotional over it. I'm sure you can understand.
Who wouldn't understand?
I know. And it's like to have this thrown into our face and have to deal with, you know, 2 years of $75,000 out to lawyers, and he was looking at a sentence like that. But he could plea bargain it out, and they would give him 10 years. And maybe the judge could be lenient. They weren't sure. But 10-year sentence for having, you know, a marital, they wanted to get married, and it's like, just because it happened on an Army base, it was like, oh, my gosh.
And are you facing a mandatory minimum here? Is he facing that, Mary, or not?
Unless he plea bargained, he was going in for 40 years, and that was if he went before a trial, a jury before a trial. And I said, I didn't know anything about the law, really, when it came to, you know, I didn't really focus on that. I mean, you raise your children, you go to church, you have a job, you grocery shop, you pay your bills.
And then suddenly your son's facing 40 years.
And it's like, and this is in Texas, and we live in Michigan.
Yeah.
So you got to remember, every time there's a trial or a hearing or something, we drive and take time off of work to go all the way to Texas for this.
It is a parent's worst nightmare. Mary, stick with us. Douglas Berman, unravel this for us as you're listening to it. I mean, it sounds like, again, one of these situations where, okay, Mary's son made a mistake, maybe not a good one, but can you see him running into mandatory minimum here that could put him in prison for 40 years for this offense?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, the facts of the case play an integral role, but one of the things that I think Mary's comments highlight is that the discretion that prosecutors have in the current system. Ironically, these mandatory rules were put in place to limit the judicial discretion and the disparities that that can create. But I think Judge Lay mentioned the fact that there's just as much disparity in the system, and that's primarily a function that now prosecutors often hold the keys literally to the jailhouse door, that they can decide what they'll allow a defendant to plead guilty to and can, as it sounds like Mary's case involved, make threats of the possibility of extraordinarily long sentences unless the defendant's willing to plead guilty. In some other cases, and this happens a lot in the drug and gun cases, the effort by the prosecutor is to get the defendant not only to plead guilty, but then to cooperate in the investigation of others involved in a conspiracy.
But this is incredible leverage. I mean, they're saying, as Mary describes it to her son, accept 10 years for this, or man, you're going to away for what might be life.
And in some sense, this gives you a sense of where the Blakely case comes out of a lot of this, that one of the concerns that had been expressed by a number of judges is that pressure, in a sense, forced defendants to give up their jury trial rights. So one aspect of the issue sort of cross-cutting all of these concerns is that these long sentences giving prosecutors the power to plea bargain this way undermines the whole set of rights that defendants have because they're facing such long sentences, they almost can't resist having to make deals just to potentially save some portion of their life.
Mary, it sounds, as a parent, as an American, this is not feeling like justice to you.
No. It is not. I mean, he has a child. He said, why can't I come out and work and pay my, you know, I would like to pay what my child needs me for. And she says, where's my daddy? I said, your daddy works in Texas on a tomato farm. That's the only thing that we can tell her at 5 years old. What are you going to tell her? Your dad's in prison?
Mary, we wish for a humane outcome here and a truly just outcome. And thank you very much for calling. Judge Lay, when you hear a story like that as a judge, it must break your heart sometimes.
Well, let me say, you know, we're all coming from different perspectives. And this interest of Mary's is certainly a personal one and very, very hard to emulate or even to substitute feelings and mm-hmm. understandings. But I want to make something very clear. At least my approach on this is not to investigate and be concerned over the lenity or the severity of sentences.
Mm-hmm.
My approach is twofold. One is to determine how we can deter further crime. And everything we've tried to date in this country has failed that measure. Our crime has risen. Our prison populations have risen. We're paying over $60 billion a year in the federal system alone for the maintenance of federal prisoners. My suggestion in this article and in the Times yesterday relates to having state drug courts. And I think people who have participated in this type of program will all tell you it's a great success. The other concern that I have, of course, is over the dehumanization that takes place when we send somebody to prison. And I think this, again, can be avoided through, to a large extent, through state drug court situations. I might say, and I'm very respectful to some of the other colleagues here speaking, and I particularly am impressed by the prosecutor on the Blakely case from the state of Washington. But, you know, I think it would be highly inappropriate for me to suggest how the Supreme Court's going to come out. But I think he puts the finger around it, and that is that it deals with procedural issues. These were flagged in a case called Apprendi about 5 years ago. And it's going to far affect the federal system. Believe me, we have over 1,000 cases in our circuit alone that we're holding until that decision comes down.
So a big backlog waiting on that. Our time's running down. John Nodell, I just want to ask you, our caller raised the issue of the leverage that the threat of these mandatory minimums can give a prosecutor. Have you used that? Have you felt as an effective tool, or have you felt, my gosh, I've got so much power here? Maybe too much.
Well, of course, in the state of Washington, we don't have as much leverage as they do in the federal court, Tom. But,
mm-hmm.
yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that the judge makes a good point, and Professor Berman makes a good point. The determinant sentencing shifts a lot of power and a lot of discretion away from judges to prosecuting attorneys. And there is a lot of leverage there, and I think, you know, speaking for myself, I know I try to use it responsibly.
Doug Berman, last word goes to you tonight. Where do you expect all this to come out? Are we going to see a very different sentencing world a year, 2 years, 3 years from now, or are we into this the strict guidelines and the public mood, the judicial mood, not there to back off?
It's a fascinating question, and it's one that has many layers, because not only are we waiting for the Supreme Court to clarify what the Blakely decision means, but again, because it's only about the procedures, Congress and state legislatures can respond once the legal landscape has been clarified by raising sentences even under the newly mandated procedures. And so one of the concerns that a lot of people have about what's going to happen in the federal system is that sentences will just get longer even if the Supreme Court grants more rights to defendants in the procedural aspect of sentencing. And so there's a lot of uncertainty. Judge Lay mentioned so many cases are backed up. The only thing I can say for certain is both stay tuned and a lot of court activity along the way.
And stay on the right side of American justice, such as it is. Douglas Berman at Ohio State, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
And John Nodell, a prosecuting attorney in Grant County Court in Washington State, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Judge Lay, we're very grateful for your time tonight, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Very good. Thank you.
Judge Donald Lay, senior judge for the U.S. Court of Appeals, 8th Circuit. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Wednesday night in New York, the National Book Award for Fiction was given to author Lily Tuck for her novel, The News from Paraguay. The book follows the story of fictional Paraguayan leader Francisco Solano Lopez and his Irish mistress, Ella Lynch. But the award was not without controversy. Before the ceremony, the talk of the literary world was that the work of the finalists for the country's top fiction award had become too esoteric and obscure. Only one of the books up for the prize this year, critics lamented, had sold more than 2,000 copies. We thought we'd let you judge a bit for yourself, and so we bring you Lily Tuck reading a passage from her National Book Award-winning novel, The News from Paraguay.
For him, it began with a feather, a bright blue parrot feather that fell out of Ella Lynch's hat while she was horseback riding one afternoon in the Bois de Boulogne. Blonde, fair-skinned, and Irish, Ella was a good rider, the kind of natural rider who rides with her ass, not her legs, and she was riding astride on a nervous little gray thoroughbred mare. Cantering a few paces behind Ella and her companion, Francisco Solano Lopez was also a good rider, albeit a different sort of rider. He rode from strength, the strength in his arms, the strength in his thighs. Also, he liked to ride big horses, horses that measured over 16, 17 hands. At home, he often rode a big, sure-footed, cantankerous brown mule. Pulling up on the reins and getting off his horse, his heavy silver spurs clanging, Franco, as Francisco Solano Lopez was known, picked the feather up from the ground. It briefly occurred to him that Inocencia, his fat sister, would know what kind of parrot feather it was, for she kept hundreds of parrots in her aviary in Asunción. But it was Ella and not the feather that had caught Franco's attention. The year was 1854, and the 40 miles of bridle paths and carriage roads were filled with elegant calèches, domons, phaetons. Every afternoon, weather permitting, Empress Eugénie could be seen driving with her equerry. Every afternoon, too, Empress Eugénie in fashion-obsessed Paris could be seen wearing a different dress, a dress of a different color, Crimean green, Sebastopol blue, Bismarck brown. The Bois de Boulogne had recently been transformed from a ruined forest into an elegant English park. Sent as ambassador at large to Europe by his father, 26-year-old Franco was dressed in a field marshal's uniform modeled on Napoleon's, only his jacket was green, Paraguayan green. He was short, stocky, not yet grown stout, nor had his back teeth begun to trouble him, and his thick eyebrows met in the middle of his forehead like a black stripe. But he was not unattractive. He was self-confident, naive, ambitious, energetic, spoiled. Never had anything, except once, one thing, been denied him. And he was possessed of an immense fortune. Franco put the feather in his pocket and mounted his horse again. He caught up with Ella easily and followed her home. At age 10, Eliza Alicia Lynch had left Ireland. At 15, Elisa Alice Lynch married a French officer. At 19, divorced and living with a handsome but impecunious Russian count, Ella Lynch needed to reinvent herself.
Author Lily Tuck reading from The News from Paraguay, which this week won the National Book Award for Fiction. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.